We're officially recording.
So I like to just do a class about mysteries of the mikvah, more from a fundamentals perspective than a esoteric mysteries perspective. I think mikvah is one of the most beautiful traditions that we have. It's an ancient tradition, goes back to the Bible itself, and a lot of what we're going to be talking about, even though it might sound complicated or convoluted, the principles that we're basing ourselves on all come either from the Bible or from the rabbinic traditions around how to interpret the Bible, specifically the Mishnah, which was written in about the year 200, so CE, Common Era. So a lot of what we're going to be discussing is easily 2,000 years old, if not even older than that. Before we get started, I'll just tell you about my first mikveh experience as a way to break the ice. So I was not raised in a world in which mikveh was anything I had heard of. My family's Jewish observance growing up was something around the lines of gefilte fish on Friday nights, and maybe grape juice, challah. That was, we were traditional, probably cultural Jews, and I have a twin brother. The two of us became more interested in Jewish observance and practice as we were getting older, and by the time we were in our teens, we'd kind of just gone head over heels, taken the dive into Jewish observance in many facets. We started trying to keep Shabbat, we started trying to keep kosher, and there was a point, I think I was 15 or 16 years old, where I had another newly religious friend who came up to me. It was probably September, we were in the middle of high school, and this is in Montreal, Canada, where high school starts in 7th grade, but there we call it grade 7, and it ends in 11th grade, otherwise known as grade 11, for us good Canadians who say Z instead of Z, and avocado instead of avocado, and pasta instead of pasta. You can kind of pick your Canadianisms. And so I think I was 15 or 16, and my friend Andy at the time, who had also gone on this trajectory of towards more Jewish practice, kind of came up to me in class one day and was like, "Hey, it's almost Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year. Do you want to go to the mikveh first?" And I was like, "What's the mikveh?" I guess at that point I'd probably heard of it. I was terrified. It was something that was very intimidating to me. Basically my thought of it, and we'll get into more of a discussion about what people use mikveh for, but my thought of it was basically going to be a men's mikveh, which I'd heard at that point that men and women generally go to mikveh separately. So I assumed it was going to be a bunch of old Hasidic naked men, which it was. It's the first mikveh experience I ever went to. If you can imagine the quintessential picture of an ultra-Orthodox Hasidic Jew from any given movie stereotype. So the side curls coming down, the long beard, the fur hats, the long black coats, the whole kit and caboodle. Hey, Nana, great to see you. That's the exact kind of part of Montreal that I walked into. Montreal's Jewish community is different than the Bay Area, to put it, that's one way to put it. Everything starts in the Bay Area and kind of trickles out to the rest of North America. So Jewishly, Montreal is probably 50 years behind the Bay Area. As an example, just growing up in Montreal, I kind of became Orthodox by default. There are four conservative synagogues in the city, one Reform synagogue, one Renewal, and dozens, if not hundreds, of Orthodox synagogues. And that's the makeup of Montreal Jewry, which is wild. It's just a different place. Anyways, so I find myself in this ultra-Orthodox synagogue. I go to the basement with my friend. I'm terrified. I'm basically shaking. And we go into the changing room. And fortunately, there was no one there at the time. Most people were outside. And then we got into the mikveh room itself. And this is, again, something you probably won't see out here in the Bay Area. I read Hebrew at that point, but not Yiddish. So I look at the wall in front of me, and I see that there's three kind of staircases going into what looked like almost tubs of jacuzzis, if I were to have to describe the appearance of it. And hey, Nana, great to see you. Does anyone have an extra copy of the sources? Nice chair. Thanks so much. Hey. And Nana, everyone, Nana. Yeah. And I was just talking about my first mikveh experience. So I get into this, inside of the mikveh, there's three pools with steps going into each. And on one side, it says Has. The other says Varm. the middle sign, and on the other side it says cult, which is Yiddish, which I didn't yet, I still don't speak Yiddish, for basically hot, warm, and cold. It's Goldilocks in the form of mikvahs. So you got to pick your desired temperature, and there were three different baths. Anyways, that was my first time going to mikvah. It's kind of, I didn't go frequently after that, but then during my time I spent in Israel, I started to take on the practice of going to mikvah more regularly. And I'm guessing that this probably might be a little surprising, because many Jews don't go to mikvah frequently. So I'll tell. We'll get into a conversation about, you know, what was motivating me to go. Yeah.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
What frightened you?
Mostly naked men. yeah. That was the big fright. That's another good thing about being in the Bay Area, where our culture is a little bit less European. Like, and by European, I mean like the old shtetl in Europe, where normally here, I think people go one at a time. You don't have like, there are definitely mikvahs in Israel and different parts of the country where you're kind of competing for real estate in the mikvah as you're trying to go in. That's not, I think, a reality here. I guess so. It's the closest thing that I've ever experienced to it. I'm a pretty prude person by basically in every part of life. So that those experiences have not been my favorite. That being said, mikvah I found to be deeply meaningful. I don't go as regularly anymore, but I still try to go before the high holidays. And when I was in college, and before that when I was studying in a yeshiva, which is a Jewish school for Talmud study in Israel, I would often go on Fridays leading into Shabbat as the holiest day of the week. So it was a practice that I took on, which is something that is done more commonly in the Hasidic community. So that's like, I thought that would be at least a little bit of an icebreaker of a story. You can hear me and my trepidation figuring out the difference between Haas, Barm, and Kalt. I'm curious to just start the discussion with, you know, let's think or brainstorm together, if you haven't looked at the sources yet, please don't. What are different contexts in which people might go to the mikvah for? So let's just have that conversation, and we'll structure our talk tonight in, I guess, four different pieces. One is, you know, what is the mikvah used for? Then what makes a mikvah? Then why is it meaningful? Like, what are the reasons in Jewish philosophy for this concept of mikvah? And finally, we'll get a tour of a mikvah. Here at Beth Jacob, we actually have two, which is just interesting. Before I ask you your thoughts, I'll just share with you that most rabbis don't spend a lot of their lives thinking about mikvah from a communal perspective. It's something that you kind of use, but you don't think a lot about how it actually gets to be there. And so I was thinking that was like my root in the rabbinate. When I was in rabbinical school, we learned a little bit about how to make a mikvah. But then I came to Beth Jacob only to find out that the money had already been raised to build a new one, and it was my job to build it. So all of a sudden I had to shore up my studies and go into great detail about how to make a kosher mikvah. And since then, we've also had the opportunity, partnering with the Federation of East Bay, to renovate our older mikvah that had been here before. It wasn't my intention coming to Beth Jacob 4.5 years ago, but I've actually had to learn a lot about what makes a mikvah kosher, what makes it appropriate for use. And it's a fascinating and also a little bit complicated conversation. So that's why I have this whiteboard here, so we can look at things and kind of draw them out. But before we get there, let's talk about what are some circumstances you're familiar with for the use of mikvah.
I've been at adult and children's or babies' conversions.
Okay, so conversion is one.
We converted our own children who were adopted, so that was... Those were two of them, and then my sister-in-law converted, and so I was a witness, I guess, at first.
Great. So conversion is probably... I think for many people, conversion is the first time they hear about mikvah. It's part of the conversion process. Traditionally, there would be, for men who are becoming Jewish, there's possibly, depending on circumstances, a form of circumcision. And then the second part is immersing in a mikvah. There's a team meeting going on here, so if they keep...
Do you want me to close the door?
Let's see. No, I think we're okay. If more people come, keep coming through, then maybe we'll do it. Actually, would you mind closing the door just for a minute? Great. So there's conversion. Any other thoughts? Why else might someone want to use the mikvah?
I know women go before they get married. I don't know if men do, though.
Yeah, great. So there's the idea of going to mikvah before marriage, which from... I'm going to divide out here Jewish law and Jewish custom, because those two things are separate of each other. From a Jewish law perspective, you're going to hear me use the word halakha often. Halakha is the Hebrew word for Jewish law. So from a Jewish law perspective, there's a mitzvah for a woman to go to mikvah before she gets married. And then there's a custom that's developed historically for men to go before marriage as well. But it's kind of, we'll keep those two things separately. Jewish law on one side and Jewish custom on the other. Okay, so before marriage. Anything else?
Koshering. Kitchen utensils.
Okay, kitchen utensils. I actually forgot to put those on the sources, and then you can see here I wrote dishes. exclamation mark. That's really exciting. There's a mitzvah to immerse dishes in a mikvah, which is probably unusual. So we'll spend a few minutes talking about that. Anything else? Let's just keep going. Yeah.
I think I've read that sometimes a woman might want to go after a divorce.
Mm-hmm. After divorce. So that's probably a more modern custom. The other context in which mikveh use is probably most prominently used in Orthodox communities is that married women will immerse in a mikveh after their menstruation cycle. As a kind of in Orthodox marriage, there's basically a period of time where husband and wife will not sleep with each other or have forms of intimate contact, and then after the end of the cycle, often 11 or 12 days after a woman gets her period, she'll immerse in a mikvah at night and then resume contact, physical, intimate contact with her husband. So that's a mitzvah as well. Anything else?
My husband went into the mikvah in Jerusalem before he took a tour of the Temple Mount.
Okay, great. So this is where we bridge the current Jewish practice with historic Jewish practice, which is that one of the major reasons that people use the mikvah when there was a temple standing in Jerusalem was that you were not allowed to enter the temple unless you were ritually pure. And tuma and tahara are the words for this. Tuma means ritual impurity, and tahara means ritual purity. And it was very common for people to be ritually impure. Because it wasn't just, there are many forms, and if you want, we can spend a year in yeshiva discussing this. there are many forms of ritual impurity in Judaism. Some of them involve seminal or vaginal emissions, so that's kind of one category, and this is where we're not going to get into too much detail there, but also touching a dead body, touching a dead animal, drinking water that had a dead bug fall inside of it, are examples of things that might render a person ritually impure. And one had to purify themselves before entering the Temple Mount or going and bringing sacrifices in the temple itself. So historically, it was very important. It was part of every ancient Israelites practice to go to a mikvah with some regularity, probably at least 3 times a year, because there was a mitzvah to ascend to the temple on the 3 Jewish holidays, pilgrimage holidays, which were Passover, Shavuot, that's the holiday where we receive the Torah, and Sukkot, the holiday of huts. And there was a tradition that every Jew in Israel would try to go to the temple. They'd also immerse in the mikvah before doing that. So it's just another piece of historical tradition, and connecting to what Allison said about her husband Paul, nowadays there's a major debate in Jewish law about whether you're allowed to ascend to the Temple Mount. It's also a major political debate as to whether Jews should be ascending to the Temple Mount, but I'm going to leave politics for some other class. If a Jew chooses to ascend to Temple Mount, then there are many rabbis who would say it's not permitted to start with, but among the ones who say that you can, they say you still have to purify yourself. And try to avoid contact with any dead bodies between the time you leave the mikvah and the time you get up to the Temple Mount, which is easier said than done because there's actually little cemeteries in the Arab quarter of the Old City of Jerusalem. So you have to be careful about how you go about that. It's actually one of the reasons that they built the mikvah in the square, in the public square at the Western Wall, so that people who want to ascend can basically go right up. Okay, great.
By people, do you mean men and women or just men?
Men and women.
But the reason I couldn't tour the Temple Mount was because they didn't have a women's mikvah time available to us before the tour. So the only woman that got to tour it was a non-Jewish woman. okay. on our tour.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it was cool.
So, happens to be my...
So much irony.
Happens to be that I, from a halachic standpoint, personally would not go up to Temple Mount anyways. So, different discussion for a different time. Okay, there's another context where... A few other contexts where mikveh use has become prevalent. Here we're now entering into the realm of customs. So the customs have developed, especially in the Hasidic community, that there are auspicious times on the calendar where a person might want to immerse in the mikveh. So one of them that's probably the most more universal is before Yom Kippur, before the Day of Atonement at the end of the High Holidays. So Yom Kippur is a day of Kapara Atonement. Also, if you look at our liturgy, the word tahara, purification, comes up very often. And the traditional way to purify oneself was immersion in the mikveh. So kind of connecting our spiritual lives of seeking atonement, seeking to kind of create a blank slate for the new year with Yom Kippur. Many people have the custom to go to the mikveh before Yom Kippur. I'll ask you another question. No pressure at all. When the Jews left Egypt, there was a 49-day journey out into the desert. We're actually reading about these in the Torah portions right now at synagogue. And the first main stop they had on the way was at Mount Sinai. And we know Mount Sinai was the location where Moses went up to, right, the top of the mountain and meets God and gets the tablets with the Ten Commandments on them. So was there anything that had to happen first? Trick question. So there was, actually, if you read this, it's explicit in the Torah that the Jewish population was supposed to wait for 3 days around the mountain. It said to circle around the mountain and camp there for 3 days and 3 nights. And it said, the text says, purify yourselves and wash yourselves so that you can be pure when you receive the Torah. And so that, our tradition interprets that, that basically everyone went to the mikveh before receiving the Torah. And so there's a custom now more practiced in parts of the Jewish community that are influenced by by mysticism, so by the Kabbalah. There are communities that immerse in the mikveh before Shavuot, before the holiday where we receive the Torah. I actually used to have a bunch of friends. I lived in Manhattan, and I would spend Shavuot on the Upper West Side, and we would kind of like sneak into the mikveh right as the sun was about to rise on Shavuot morning. It was a tradition to stay up all night learning Torah on Shavuot. And so we would study Torah the entire night. And right as the sun was about to rise, which we believe is the time that God actually gave the tablets to Moses, we would jump into the mikveh, go into our prayers, and like spiritually prepare to receive the Torah. So that's one of the times in my life where I've practiced mikveh use. And then there's also an idea that is fairly common for people to immerse in the mikveh. It's more often men than women, but there is room for both, before Shabbat, every Friday afternoon. And so you'll see communities where this is commonplace. We have a community mikveh that is used by the entire Jewish Bay Area. We have people coming from Sacramento, from the peninsula, from San Francisco, because it's one of the few, if not the only mikveh in the Bay Area, which is open for anyone to use if they just call the office and ask to. So we have a group of Hasidic rabbis every Friday, like inevitably, I kind of got to know them now because they're here every Friday, who come in and use the mikveh before Shabbat. So that's another example. And I used to do that before I was a pulpit rabbi, and Fridays are now my busiest day of the week. That's another example. And let's now go into part two, which is what makes a kosher mikveh. So I'll ask you to describe, can you raise your hand if you've been to a mikveh or if you've seen one? Okay. So when you go and see a mikveh, you'll often see what looks like a small swimming pool. Sometimes it looks a little bit like a spa. And it's reasonably simple, but behind what you see, there's a lot going on. And so I just want to spend a little bit of time describing what makes a mikveh in Jewish tradition. So other things you're gonna see, by the way, is normally some kind of bathroom setup with a tub or a shower. There's an idea that you want to go into the mikveh totally already physically clean, both for the sanitation of the mikveh, but also so that there's nothing dividing or blocking between your skin and the water that you're immersing in. So you'll often see a bath or a shower and a sink just for like getting ready for the mikveh. So once you go into a mikvah, you basically just see a bath. But behind that, there's a lot going on, and I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about it. So first, if you look at your source sheet, first side of the page, what makes a kosher mikvah? If this were a Beth Jacob class, I'd force you to all do some reading, but I'm going to have mercy on you because Dawn invited you, and she's a nicer person than I am. So I'm going to read the first source here, and this is in Leviticus. Vayikra, it's the third book out of the five books of Moses, and it's discussing an interesting question, which is, if a dead animal falls into a pool of water, does the pool of water become ritually impure? So remember before we were saying that dead animals create ritual impurity, so does that transfer to the pool? And so this is what the verse comes to address, and let's read it together. This is Leviticus chapter 11, verse 36. I'm going to read it in Hebrew and translate. Ach ma'ayan ubor mikveh mayim. However, if the animal falls into a ma'ayan, you may have heard that as a Hebrew name. It's often used as a woman's name. So ma'ayan means a spring, some kind of small river. Ubor mikveh mayim, and this is tough to translate, a cistern, some kind of hole that contains within it water. Then yiyet tahor, it will remain clean or ritually pure. And however, if you end up touching the dead body of an animal yourself, you might become impure, okay? So ignore the second part of the verse for now. And if you actually look carefully, there's two different definitions of mikveh here. The first kind of mikveh is a river, is some kind of river or spring. And the second kind of mikveh is defined as bor mikveh mayim, a cistern that holds within it water. The two kinds of mikvahs are actually they have different laws pertaining to each of them, but they both work. For example, if you are stuck, if you're someone who's careful to immerse your dishes in a mikvah, and you're stuck and the Beth Jacob office is closed and you don't know where to go, you're able to go down to the bay and take your pots and pans and dunk them in the water. That any kind of natural body of water, like a spring, would count as a kosher mikvah. Even if it's flowing. However, then there's a second category of creating a bore, a cistern that also contains within it water. So that is the common form of mikvah that 95% of people who end up using mikvah end up using, right? Because I don't know about you, in the middle of January, even in the Bay Area, you don't have to be in Montreal to feel like the water's a little cold this time of year. So for that reason and for others, most of the time we build our own mikvahs. But building our own mikvahs, according to the tradition, the cistern form of mikveh, which is basically what we all use, creating a pool for yourself, has to be similar in some ways to the mayan, to the spring form, or the running natural water form of mikveh. How so? So three qualifications. One is the water in it has to come, the language here that's used in the Midrash, I'm jumping to source three, this is the third source, it's a Midrash from about 2,000 years ago. Is that it has to become bidei shamayim, through the hands of heaven, right? No human hand can affect the direction of the water, just like in a spring. Just like a spring flows naturally, so too the water that gets collected in the cistern mikveh has to have gotten there naturally. And I'll tell you about the complications of making this happen nowadays, okay? The second law is that imagine water has been collected in a place, and now you want to move it, right? So maybe I want to go down to, do most people live in Oakland? Just kidding. Maybe I want to go down to Lake Merritt and just draw some buckets of water and bring them with me to my bath at home, and I'll put them in the bath, and then I'll dunk in the bath, and then I'll have a kosher mikvah. So the second requirement is that just as a spring has never had the water lifted out of it, so to a bore, a cistern mikveh, also the water has to have arrived there and cannot have ever been pulled up, cannot have ever been taken out. So that's the second requirement. The third, and this is where you have to be a really precise reader of biblical text, because the Midrash has a rule that anytime you see the word but in Hebrew, an ach, that's the Hebrew word, it comes to limit something. So there's something limited about a cistern kind of mikveh that is not true for the spring kind of mikveh. And the rule that we learn is that a spring mikveh, right, a mikveh that's made of just a flowing source of water, any small spring is good enough. But for a cistern mikveh, you need a large amount of water. We're going to get back to this later when we talk about the philosophy. How much water is enough water? So, of course, we have an answer about this. We have question and answers and lots of texts about it. So the Talmud tries to suggest that you need a pool that is large enough to fit an entire human body comfortably. And when the Mishnah, the source from 1800 years ago, explains what that is, they give an ancient Mesopotamian measurement, which is 40 measurements known as a sa'a, 40 se'a or sa'a. In contemporary terms, 200 gallons. It's a fair amount of water. And that 200 gallons of water has to have fallen naturally and never been altered or picked up by human hands. Which leads to the question of, how do you make a mikveh? Right. So, any thoughts?
Big funnel on the roof.
Big funnel on the roof. Okay. I feel like you've done this before. Okay, so this is actually what we've had to do when we built our new mikveh 3 years ago here at Beth Jacob. We have two sides of the synagogue. If you walked into the main sanctuary, you saw we have a really deep slope. So that's complicated. It's hard to build stuff on a slope. On the other side, we have a big social hall. And on the side of the social hall, you can just imagine like a rectangle roof. We had to build a massive rain catcher. I don't remember the exact dimensions. It was somewhere around 60 by 30 feet. And it was sloped downwards a little so that the water would basically all slope over here. And then we had a catchment drain that would come here. So the water would continue sloping. It would continue to slope kind of from off the rain catcher onto the side. And then here's the complicated thing. So our mikveh that we were building was two floors below the roof. So we couldn't just have a pipe just go from the roof down into the mikveh because it would basically create a leak in our kitchen. Like, that's our social hall. So what were we going to do? We originally came up with a pipe system where we were basically going to use drainage pipes to have the water flow down naturally just using gravity. But that's no different in the halachic treatment than a spring, that water in springs also flow because of gravity, right? Except then we found out that there's a source that if you have any rivet in a pipe that could collect water and force water not to go out, even if it's a minuscule amount, that renders the entire water unfit for mikveh use. So we then came up with, and this is through consultation with experts, I had a Hasidic rabbi, you know, big beard, the whole thing, probably in his 60s, who's a Hasidic rabbi in Brooklyn. I had him use FaceTime for the first time in his life to help us build this mikveh. So that was for a different thing that I'll tell you about later. But we were consulting with him, and he basically gave us the straw method. So it's a straw method. You basically buy PVC piping, and you make sure that one PVC pipe opens into the hole of another PVC pipe. You getting the idea here?
Mm-hmm.
And you keep going down, and we basically had this really complicated... It's actually not complicated. It's basically like a toddler using straws to build a project. But we basically had these pipes, one PVC pipe going into another, into another, into another, off the side of the roof, then down the roof two floors, and we had to take out a glass tile for our mikveh to get the pipe from outside inside, and then eventually collecting into a cistern, which is our mikveh itself. Okay. So that's the easy part. So far, so good?
Grandma, I have a question. How much water though was lost by using PVC pipes instead of... I mean, obviously this is the perfect way to do it, but I guess like the... whatever, some people would term the more efficient ways to just use the normal pipes. So is there like a lot of water lost by using this method? Or?
So we were really anxious about that because we were building this in the middle of the major drought. And we had finished... There was a whole, like... Everything was complicated about this, including that we were having a lot of construction delays,
right.
And we were worried that we weren't going to finish by the rain season. So I think we ended up finishing the construction of the cisterns. Notice I said cisterns and not just one. We'll get there later. So we finished it in like December, and thank God there was a major rainfall about 2 weeks after that. So we ended up having like more than enough rain. We had to cut out the pipes at some point because we had overfilled our mikvahs, which was great. Yeah. So this is what we did. We had a backup plan also, which is that the Talmud even discusses this. If you don't have any rain, The Talmud says that you can bring snow and let snow melt and then naturally descend.
Wow.
So we were going to go up to Tahoe and bring some back with us in truckloads. Then we were trying to figure out if that happens, how are we going to get truckloads to the top of the roof?
Yeah.
It was a whole different discussion.
Wow.
Fortunately, we didn't have to go there. Yeah, it's... Okay, so I said 200 gallons, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'll now tell you that in the end, we needed 800 gallons of rain. So let's get on to the problems here. Okay, so turn your source sheet if you'd like. If not, I'm happy to describe it for you. So you can imagine that if you just had this system, right? So Matt, you figured out your way to get all of your rain and get it dumped into a cistern. So I don't know about you, but that doesn't seem so hygienic. Right, because now you have the same rainwater that's going to be used for days, weeks, months, and eventually years. How do you deal with the hygiene aspects of that? So that's one problem. Any ideas?
Are you allowed to chemically treat the water?
Are you allowed to chemically treat the water? Likely yes. Yeah. That's one option. Fortunately, there's an easier one.
Filtration?
Filtration. Heating, so maybe you can pasteurize the water a few times every once in a while and remove any bugs. Great. So
you have continuous flow.
Yeah, keep it flushing through.
So keep the rain coming up from the top of the roof and keep
in
it coming down.
Just have a constant.
Okay, so we're going to, remember I mentioned that there's two different forms of mikvah, right? There's the spring form and then there's the cistern form. So if you go with the cistern roof, which is what most of us end up doing, then there's actually a lot. I was going to talk about this at the end. That if the cistern, it has to be a complete bore, a complete cistern.
Mm.
If there's even a tiny crack that allows any water out, the entire mikvah is rendered non-kosher.
Oh.
So, great idea, and you'll see that we find a way to make this work, but that's not the easiest. It would be the easiest way to do it, but it's not the way we end up doing it nowadays. So, fortunately, the Mishnah from 1800 years ago discussed these questions, and we have a few solutions, so I'm going to go through them now quickly. The first solution is a Hebrew term called Zaria. For those of you who took Sunday school Hebrew, Zaria, I'll first write it in Hebrew. Zaria means literally to plant. It's coming from the word of Zera means seed. So it's a planting method. So what does this mean? This is the example that's given in the Mishnah. Imagine for yourself that you have two parallel cisterns. These are probably holes in the ground, okay? And so you have kosher water on one side. Let's say this was all collected naturally, but then you have a little bit of human dumped water on the other side. So is there any way to make this side kosher? So what the Talmud suggests is that, the Mishnah suggests this, is that once you get to your kosher mikvah on this side, can everyone see this? Once you get to your kosher mikvah on this side, you can now insert humanly drawn water. It goes into that side. It takes on the status of the original water. You can imagine it's kind of it's like the water's converting to kosher mikvah water. It's like taking on that status. And then eventually it overflows, right? Offsets into the other side, fills up the other bore, the other cistern, and now through the act of Zaria, they're planting, you're kind of putting new stuff in here so that it transfers over to the other side.
Mm-hmm.
You're growing your mikvah, right? So through that process called Zaria, how did I translate it here? Planting, okay. Through that process, you can now create a second cistern. So how does this work in contemporary mikvahs? So when you immerse in a mikvah, you're not immersing in the in the original rainwater. You're immersing in water that has actually been both filtered and cleaned, but also removed and replaced. And the way that it's replaced is through this system. So the water that was originally filled up is in a room that you don't normally see. We're going to get a look at it. We're going to get to look at it tonight. The real mikvah is you don't ever get to see when you go to immerse. It's normally hidden in the back room somewhere. And people, when they're ready to clean a mikvah, they empty this side out. It doesn't look like this, right? But they empty the part that people immerse in out. They wash the walls, clean it. And then when it's time to refill, they just pour more water into this side, let it offset in back into the bath where people actually immerse. So that's the first form. Right? There's another solution as well, which is what if you have kosher rainwater here and non-kosher rainwater here, and they're both already filled? So this is the good side, this is the side that's not working, okay? Mm-hmm. So what do you do? So the Talmud actually says there's a process called hashaka. Hashaka is similar to the word nishika in Hebrew, which means a kiss. So if you allow waters to kiss each other, if you allow contact, so let's say you now lower the barrier between the two so that there's contact between the mikvah water and the non-mikvah water, then the non-mikvah water takes on the status of the original mikvah water. Okay, so that's the second process called hashaka. What do we do nowadays? So because there's a general principle that with mikvahs, we try to be as strict in constructing them as possible. We try to basically apply every possible stringency so that if anything, any important life event happens in that mikvah, no one can question the validity of that life event. So we take on as many stringencies as possible. Most mikvahs nowadays are built with some form of both of these, a combination of both. So when we were filling our new mikvah, which is not the one we're going to tour tonight, we actually built one cistern of water that's used to replenish the mikvah, and actually underneath the mikvah, a second cistern of water that just has a little hole that constantly touches the mikvah where people actually go in. Does that make sense?
So it's pouring in, kissing.
So it's pouring in, right, on one from the side. Mm-hmm. That's what we call the borzria, the cistern of planting, and then the kissing is happening from underneath, which is an additional stringency that we're not going to get into now, because the mikvah we're going to see now has the second one on the side, and we just have one that is used for refilling and one that's used just for kissing or contact. There's a new stringency, because every few years you seem to find new rabbis with new opinions. And so now, this is actually a Chabad custom, a Lubavitch custom, to have your second bore, the one that's not used for the overflow, but used just for the contact, to put it underneath as a way to basically guarantee that water can never be emptied out. Just from gravity alone, it's going to be extremely hard to do that. So that covers most of it. I'll just tell you, because we can never be too strict, that the Talmud as a general rule, I disagree with that. But the Talmud adds another rule, or another idea, which is that even if you have drawn water, that at least on some level, if the drawn water is then poured onto the ground and it travels a distance of about 40 inches on the ground, that once it's traveled 40 inches on the ground, on some level it becomes as if it was groundwater to start with. That process is called hamshacha, drawing water, basically causing water to pour. And you'll see nowadays that most mikvahs are filled with these concrete troughs, that you first fill it into a porous concrete, it then flows into the borzria, the planting cistern. Then from there it overflows into the actual mikvah that people use, and all the while you still have contact from the side. Mm-hmm. So we kind of have this triple proof mikvah system that ends up being used in most contemporary mikvahs. Okay, so far so good?
Yeah, sounds like the easiest way is jump in the ocean.
Yeah, except, right, in Montreal, except in Montreal in January, right, mm-hmm. when that might be a life-threatening event.
Or in San Francisco, anytime.
Right, yeah. The coldest winter day is this summer.
Yeah.
Coldest winter I've ever had is summer day in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Great.
Right,
yeah.
But the third bore.
Yeah.
To be in contact with the second one, there has to be a hole.
There is a hole, yeah.
But I thought you weren't allowed to have a hole in a bore.
A hole in a bore? That's a great question. As long as its kind of total circumference is waterproof, then it would be fine. This actually came up for us because when we were building our stairs for our new mikvah, we had the question. It was just from an engineering perspective, way easier to have an empty hole underneath the stairs. And so we tried to figure out, because we had to change the foundation. It was like a complicated project. And it would have been much easier to make a box than to have a slant. And the answer that we were told is that even the risk of having like a 3 or 4 inch concrete gap is too high, that you may eventually have water leak out of here into the crawl space or the empty space underneath the staircase. So instead, we had to make a foundational change where we had an angle going into horizontal. It's kind of complicated, but it worked out. I told you before that I was going to mention the FaceTime with the Hasidic rabbi. So what this came up with was about how to ensure that the concrete pour is good enough or high quality enough of a pour that there's no risk of cracks in the bottom of, in the foundation of the mikveh. And so I had him basically talking to our contractors as they were beginning their pour, making sure that this was all new to me. I've never done like a home renovation or anything. Making sure that the kind of mixture of concrete was strong enough, that the sealant that they were using over the concrete was the right kind of sealant, and that the pour itself was thick enough in any given place. I think the rule was 9 inches of thickness from any point to the bottom of the foundation. So it was a really interesting and complicated project.
Did he have rebar in it?
I think so. Yeah, there was definitely rebar, but what I don't remember is if we had to pour an additional 9 inches on top of the rebar. I don't remember the answer to that. I'd have to go back and look. Are you in construction?
Or no, he's a structural engineer, so...
Oh, cool.
And we just had concrete poured, so okay. I learned about how concrete...
Yeah.
No one will guarantee that it will not crack.
Yeah.
No one will guarantee it. So I hear this one talking about, like, get a little rebar in there, get a lot of rebar in there.
Uh-huh. Right. So that's what you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. He's the structural engineer. I'm just the muse.
Great. Yeah. So hopefully we're not having any cracks in ours. There is a way to test for cracks that like the expert rabbis in this field have come up with, where you basically try to equalize out for evaporation and still figure out whether beyond the rate of evaporation there's any water that's leaking out. It itself is a complicated process, but there are tests to do for that. Within the tradition, I guess it's a pretty modern form of the tradition. And the honest thing is, I don't know how 400 years ago people could know everything that we know now about like construction techniques. So it's an interesting example of where Jewish law has evolved strictly because of technological advancements, right? Like the fact that there's something called rebar and that there's sealants on concrete, like. That's amazing, and it's just fascinating in and of itself. Okay, part three, why does this all matter? Right, so we talked about some of the details, and then I hope we're gonna have, our end time is officially 8:30?
Yes, because you have twins.
Thank you for that sensitivity, I appreciate it. Okay, so then I'm just gonna go and talk about what I think is the most beautiful kind of explanation for the mikvah as a concept. So, we have ideas about the mikveh being kind of a return to a primordial self. So it's basically a return to some kind of beginning or an origin. I'll tell you this in terms of the Kabbalistic tradition, the mystical tradition itself, and why it talks about mikveh, and then we're going to bring it back to all these different ways that the mikveh is used and how they all connect together. Okay, so if you look at the first letter of mikveh, is the Hebrew letter men. I'm going to write it out in English, M-E-M. And then in Hebrew, there's different forms of mem for a first letter and then a last letter. It's something like this. Allison, you're the Hebrew teacher. How am I doing here?
Very good.
Okay. Great. So in the Jewish tradition, each Hebrew letter has a numerical equivalent. And the numerical equivalent, what's called the gematria of mem, is 4-0, is 40. Does anyone remember where we talked about 40 before?
That was how much water.
Right. So the minimal requirement for the volume of a mikvah is 40 sa'ah. It's a Mesopotamian measurement. It's used in the Bible. But there's an idea of the volume of a mikvah being equivalent to 40, being connected to the number 40. The letter mem itself is a powerful letter in many ways. It's the middle letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So anyone know what the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet is?
Aleph.
Okay, so if you put an aleph at the beginning... Sorry, my Hebrew. I normally write cursive, and I'm trying to write this backwards. So you'll imagine that that's an aleph for a second. That's a really bad aleph. Okay.
Keep going.
Keep going. Thanks,
Aleph. Keep talking.
Okay. So the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet is aleph. The middle letter is mem. And the final letter?
Top.
Great. That word together creates the Hebrew word emet, which means truth. There's something beautiful and truthful about the Hebrew language. And kind of ancient. If you were to take the first two letters of that word, put an aleph and a mem together, you get the word aim, which means a mother, the provider and creator of life. If you were, on the other hand, to take the second two letters of that word, mem and taf, and put them together, you get the Hebrew word mate, which means death. So the mem is a connecting word. It's a transition between life and death, right? It can either be the connection between bringing new life into the world, or sometimes on occasion it can be the connection from this world to death from this world, which is really a transition into the world to come. So mem, representing mikvah in the Kabbalistic tradition, is really the representation of extreme transition. Where do we see 40, the numerical value of mem, in the Bible?
40 years in the desert.
So we see the Jews spent 40 years in the desert, right?
The flood.
The flood, right, in Genesis, when God decides that the world had messed up and wants to start everything over again, God brings a flood to flood the entire world, and the rain falls for 40 days and 40 nights. So you see the word 40 there. Anything else?
400 years of slavery.
400 years of slavery, great. So it's a multiple of 40, but we're Kabbalists, we can mess up a little. We can mess around with the numbers a little bit. 40 years in the desert, do we have that one yet?
Yeah.
And also the Talmud says something fascinating, and this has implications in a whole variety of contexts. The Talmud says that from the conception of a child to the form where the embryo takes on human form is 40 days, which is just a fascinating idea in the Talmud. And I think there's, I'm not a doctor, but I think there's something in terms of human development that actually matches that in science. So 40 is a point of rebirth, right? When God decides to destroy the world he created, right? God rebirths the world through water, by the way, and not coincidentally, through water. And that water has its rebirth process over 40 days, right? When the Jewish people get the Torah, right, receiving the Torah is a rebirth of the Jewish people. It's really the transition point from a family to a nation, right? When we accept the covenant of the Ten Commandments. And that birth takes place over 40 days. Many of the traditional Jewish philosophers think about the 40 years in the desert as a re-entry of the Jewish people into the womb of the desert. It's kind of God holding us in this back in the womb, almost as a rebirthing process. And that rebirth from slave nation to free nation takes place over 40 years. And finally, right, the idea in the Talmud is that a child taking form, taking on a new identity, it happens in the first 40 days after conception. So mikvah is entering in with one identity and exiting reborn with a new status. If you think about all the examples we gave earlier about when a mikvah is used, right, we started, and probably the most obvious of them is the conversion process. Right? A person steps into the waters of the mikvah with one identity, and when they step out, they've taken on their new identity as a Jew. This happens when a person goes in for ritual purity reasons. For example, for women who go to the mikvah on a monthly basis, they step in after having had their period with a status of ritual impurity, and they step out newly purified. When men in the times of the temple, it was women or men, had touched a dead body, and this is still true if you want to go to Temple Mount today, but you enter in and your identity is somehow associated with a ritual impurity. And when you step out, you've taken on ritual purity again. Even dishes. The best explanation I've ever heard about dishes and why we need to kosher them, why we need to put them in a mikveh, the word for that is tevila, T-E-V-I-L-A, for tevila to kelim, to immerse vessels, is that originally their identity was that they were normal dishes. But now they're going to be dishes used in, hopefully, with the laws of kosher in a kosher home. The dishes themselves are taking on a new identity before they enter into a Jewish home. So a mikveh is a transition point of former identity to new identity. It's a rebirth. And rebirth in Judaism is closely associated with water, with the mem, right, the middle of the Hebrew alphabet, the transition, the difference between giving birth and death itself. Happens in a mikvah of 40 sa'ah, the volume of 40 that is found in a mikvah. So there's a lot more there. There's a lot of there.
Mayim itself starts with mem.
Mayim itself starts with mem. There's a Kabbalistic work that says that whenever you see the word mem, the letter mem, you shouldn't read it as mem, you should read it as mayim. The word itself, right, all you have to do is put between two mems a yud, and you get the Hebrew word mayim. So mem 40 is deeply associated with water. when God first created the world, and we'll finish this, before there was a continent, according to Genesis, before there was any plant life, any animal life, any human life, the text in Genesis verse 2, the second verse in the whole Torah, says, "V'ruach Elokim rachefet al pnei amayim," that the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the earth. Sorry, over the face of the water, right? There's something, I think we can all feel it when you're out at an ocean, when you're looking out to the ocean from a beach, where you just feel something expansive, right? Something that takes you out of your current place and just transports you further. There's an expression in our tradition that if you've ever seen fringes on the side of a tallit, traditionally those two of those fringes would be dyed in a color of blue. It's called the tchelet. And the dye, according to the Talmud, was there to remind us that you look at the blue on your tallit and you see the blue of the ocean, and the blue reminds you of the blue of the sky, and the blue of the sky reminds you of the blue on God's throne. There's something about kind of entering into water and expansiveness that draws us outside of us and takes us out of our world and into God's world. And ultimately, that's what a mikvah is there for. It can be an incredibly spiritually meaningful moment, and there are different applications for when it's used in a variety of contexts. It's not a mitzvah that is often taken advantage of as much as it can be, and hopefully this will inspire you to find ways to incorporate mikvah into your life as well. My thought is that let's go do a tour, and then we can sit down at the back of the sanctuary and answer questions, or if you want to go home, that's totally fine too. But I just don't want to keep you here longer. So let's go do it for it.
Do you want to do this?
Sure. Yeah, don't mind.